It's interesting that when you went to my site, you saw Eugene Schwartz. I have studied Eugene Schwartz and his great copywriting, and I have studied some of the ads that he wrote for you. My students at hardtofindseminars.com, lots of copywriters, they think Eugene Schwartz is the king of copy and direct mail response. And I thought talking about that story and how that occurred and how you built an information products business, because it looks like that's what you did, and I'd like to talk about some of that and just some of your career. I think it'd be fascinating.
Eugene Schwartz and I became very close friends. He and his wife Barbara and my wife Renee. We spent many evenings together, etc., etc. But it started when Frederick Fell, who's long gone now also, he published my first book, How to Develop a Superpower Memory. That was back in 1956.
How old were you in 1956?
So I was 30 years old.
Where were you born?
I am as an original New Yorker as you can get. I was born on the Meade streets of the Lower East Side of Manhattan, right off the East River.
I see. And what'd your parents do?
Oh, boy. They were professional poor people. I had an awful childhood. I'm a depression kid. I remember having a potato for dinner, that kind of thing. But fortunately, it took me about 20 years. I don't know if you know New York City, but I was born, as I told you, on the Lower East Side, right off the East River. It took me about 20 years to move all the way west near the Hudson River, which is where I'm sitting right now in an $8 million townhouse. But it took me about 20 years to make that move. They're two different worlds. As long as you asked, I'll tell you about the Lower East Side. There is a very important drive along the East River called the FDR Drive. And when I was a boy, it was not there. It was just the banks of the river, and that's where the city dumped its garbage. And the garbage became petrified hills. They were long, petrified, like mountains of garbage, and that was our playground. That's what my friends and I played on when I was a little boy.
Right. Are you Jewish?
Yes.
Harry Lorraine, is that your real name?
That's my name, yes.
Okay, wonderful. So what did your parents do? Did you grow up poor?
Yes, absolutely. There's no other word for it. My father was a part-time. He died when I was 12. You know, it's very difficult to put it into the real concept, but when I say they were professional poor people, what I mean is, like, my wife is about the same age as me. She's a little younger. They were also poor people, but they were able to live better. My parents couldn't. It went out of my mind. I didn't want to remember. It was not a good childhood.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
One brother. He's gone now.
How young are you now?
Well, I was born in 1926. I'm 85 years old.
How was your teenage years? Were you a good boy, or did you cause a lot of trouble?
Well, caused a lot of trouble until I was 16 and got the heck out of that area. I started to leave that area at about that age. You see what it is, Michael, there was no television when I was a boy. So I thought the whole world lived the way I did. It's not like now where people watch television. You see how the other part of the world lives. It was not that way when I was a boy. Like I say, I thought the whole world lived like we did on the Lower East Side, what I always called the mean streets. It was a ghetto. I don't know if there was such a word being used at that time, but that's what it was.
So where'd you go when you were 16?
Well, I still stayed there, but then I went into the Army when I was 17 and a half. I enlisted. I was going to be drafted anyway, I thought. I weighed 110 pounds when I got into the Army. When I got in the first day, I was told, you know, if you weigh 109, they wouldn't take you. So all I had to do was run around the block three times and I'd weigh 109, you know. But I enlisted because I thought if you enlisted, you got a better deal. You could choose what part of the Army you'd want to be in. It didn't work out that way. It was not a very good choice. I ended up in what was called the IRTC, which stands for Infantry Replacement Training Center. You see, we were losing the war at that time. This is right after Tan and the Guadalcanal thing. We were losing the war. Look, if they took me, then we had to be losing the war.
Where did you go to?
Well, they put me into this IRTC. See, we took intelligence tests, and I thought if you got a good mark, you know, if you were really intelligent, then you could, you know, go into a nice, safe area. It was just the opposite, Michael. They needed people, like I just said, to go into this infantry replacement training center so you can learn everything an infantry man had to know in 17 weeks. It was a 17-week training course. And that took some intelligence because what the infantry replacement training center was a suicide squad. In other words, you went overseas, and alphabetically, whoever was killed or wounded, you took that person's place, and you had to be able to do what that person was doing. In other words, which firearms he was using, you know, what his position was in the infantry. So it was not a very good experience.
Did you score high on those intelligence tests?
Yes, that was the trouble. I shouldn't have.
At that age, 16, were you intelligent?
No, this was 17 and a half at that time when I enlisted in the Army.
Were you a smart, intelligent kid?
Oh, boy, that's a good question.
How'd you do in high school, your grades and stuff?
When I got to high school, then I was fine. It was grade school. That's what changed my life. Let me see if I can get into it this way, Michael. I'm on television, and the host says to me, Harry, how did you become the world's foremost memory training teacher? How does that happen? And I said, stomach cramps. And he turned white under his makeup. He thought I had flipped my lid. You know, we went into a commercial, and I said, don't worry, it's a cliffhanger. I'll explain it. Let me explain what this guy said to me. How does one become the world's foremost memory training expert? And I said, stomach cramps. That's what started it, Michael. Now, do you want to hear this story?
I want to hear the story. Absolutely.
Okay, I'll tell you the story because you asked me about when I was a teenager. Forget that. When I was 10 and a half, 11 years old, I got stomach cramps every morning. And I thought that was the norm. I thought everybody had stomach cramps. Till I realized that it was only Mondays through Fridays. In other words, school days. Saturdays and Sundays, I didn't have stomach cramps. So it was school days. Now, let me tell you why. There was Mrs. Goldfish, who was my teacher. I'll never forget her, and I could visualize her very clearly. And every day, we got a 10-question test on a yellow rectangular piece of paper, which we numbered from 1 to 10. These are things that there's no way I could forget them because it was a plot point for me. It changed my life. We used to have these 10 questions, which she would grade that same day. And here's the point. We had to take it home so at least one parent would sign it to prove that we showed it to a parent. And as I told you a few moments ago, my father died when I was 12 years old. So when I was 10 and a half, 11, he was the signee. He was the one I had to show this test to. And the point is, I was always getting failing grades. Whereas my little classmates, they were all getting, you know, 70s and 80s, whatever passing grades were. I was getting 40s and 50s. In other words, failing. Well, when I brought it home to my father to sign, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, Michael. I was talking about this on the Johnny Carson show. Okay, on the Tonight Show. And I was telling this story. And when I got to this point of the story that I'm telling you now, I brought the paper home for my father to sign, and he would look at the failing grade, and he would punch me. And I told the story. Now I'll continue the story about punch you. And what happened is about 2 weeks after I did that particular show, I was on the Carson Show 23 times, so this was one of the early ones. And I got a call from Freddie DeCordova. Freddie DeCordova was the producer of the Tonight Show at that time. And he said, oh, Harry, we got 8,000 calls and letters and things. And at first I wanted to say, great, I did good. He said, no, they were all negative. I said, negative, why? He said, because you said your father punched you. They didn't like that. So I found out that you can't say that on television, Michael. So now when I tell the story, and I'm telling it to you now, I brought the 10-question test to my father. I had 40 on it, a failing grade. He punished me. That's okay. That's the way I tell the story now.
Well, we're not national TV. I like to get the real story. Is that what motivated you?
Yeah, because what happened is that's the reason for the stomach cramps. You see, I'm trying to round out the story here because I was scared, not of getting failing grades, but of getting hit by my father. So that's what was causing the stomach cramps. And this is the way it was every school day until one day, and here comes the plot point. I'm walking to school. Those days, if they were, I didn't know about them. There were no school buses. I walked to school. And all of a sudden, I stopped and the light bulb went on in my head. And I said, wait a minute. You know, I found out in later years that I was dyslexic. And I am very dyslexic. But we didn't have that word when I was a kid. And if they did, I didn't know it. So they give you the name, you play the game. They stamped me moron when I was a little boy. So you play the game. So as I'm walking to school that particular day, I said, wait a minute. Why are my classmates all getting passing grades and I'm getting failing grades? Because there's no intelligence involved here. There's no smart involved here. Not the kind of questions you get at that age, like, what's the capital of Maryland? It's the kind of question either you know it or you don't. In other words, you can't intellectualize it. I didn't know that word when I was a little boy, but that's what it boils down to. In other words, I just realized at that point in my life that all you had to do is remember the darn answers to the question, and then you'll get a passing grade, and then, more important, your father won't punch you. So that changed my life because now I thought, wait a minute, how can I help myself to remember the answers to these darn questions that Mrs. Goldfisher had mentioned in class or read it in a page that she told us to read that day? That's what changed my life because I ended up at the Pitt Street Park Library, we call it. The actual name was Hamilton Fish, but it was on Pitt Street, so we called it the Pitt Street Library. and I asked the lady behind the counter if there was any books that could help me remember. And I'll tell you something, Michael, she took me to a room where we had to push away cobwebs to get in. Nobody had been in there in 100 years, probably. And it was one of those rooms that had books on different subjects. And in one corner, there were a few books on the subject of memory training. And she left me in there. Remember, I was 10 and a half, 11 years old, so 99.9% of the stuff I was reading, I didn't understand. But that 1%, that changed my life, because what I started to do was change it to help me remember the things I want to remember, like, what's the capital of Maryland? What's the chief export of so-and-so? What's the vice president's name? You know, things like that. I remember that lady, the librarian, coming in every half hour to make sure I was okay, because I stayed in there for hours. And that's what I say after that, incidentally, to round out the story, I started to get hundreds on Mrs. Goldfish's tests. And, of course, then my father stopped punching me. And one day, Mrs. Goldfish said to me, Harry, what happened? Now you're getting marks that I thought you always should get. What happened? And I told her, well, I learned how to remember. She said, what do you mean? And I gave her an example. Like, I said, well, there's a girl, Mary, in the class, and I want to remember that the capital of Maryland is Annapolis, because most people say Baltimore. The capital of Maryland is Annapolis. And I said, gee, I visualized Mary with an apple landing on her head. Mary, land. Annapolis landing. And apple is. That reminded me of Annapolis. And as I'm telling this to Mrs. Goldfisher, I see the curtain come down over her eyes. She thought I was nuts. She said, all right, Harry, sit down.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Oh, my God. So the books you were reading back then, who were your mentors who really made it stick for you, even at that young age?
Nobody. No name I can remember. Nobody you would remember. But I'm telling you, there were people way back then, like Aristotle. I'm going back 3,000 years now. I don't have his books. I wish I did. But he's been quoted in a lot of the books that I have about saying, in order to think, we must speculate with images. That was the first line of one of his books, and that's a big part of my memory training systems. You speculate with images. It helps you think.
What's the name of this memory system?
There were no names then. They were just called how to remember or memory training or things like that. There were two people that I knew when I was very young. One of them was a man named David Roth. He died when he was 96. When I was growing up, he was the main when I got interested in this particular subject. This is a David Roth, died many, many years ago. Like I say, died when he was 96. He used to call me because he knew about my books and etc., etc. And he always called and said, gee, Harry, I can't do what you do. He meant my remembering 400 names on the Carson Show, things like that. But anyway, on his 95th birthday, I was invited, but I couldn't make it. He was almost like the number four member of the Rotary Club. And he said to me, Harry, on my birthday, I'm not going to do much. Remember, he was 95. He said, I'm just going to remember all the guys in the audience and their telephone numbers. That's what he did with 100 people in the audience when he was 95. So hopefully using your brain that way helps you live longer, you know. But he's the one I remember, David Roth, and there was a fellow by the name of Bernard Zufall, who wrote some pamphlets on this subject. And those are really all those that I knew when I was growing up.
Okay, so once you learned this thing and you started changing your grades to 100s on your test and you weren't getting punched by your dad, did you use this feverishly as you continued through your grade school and then high school?
Yes, that became a way of life, but it was a personal thing. See, what happened when all these things, like I say, the little plot points, like when Mrs. Goldfish's eyes glazed over when I was telling her how I remembered the capital of Maryland is Annapolis, I realized that people were going to think I'm nuts. I couldn't care less. I was only interested in my father not hitting me. So I couldn't care less. But what happened was my classmates started to say, Harry, what the heck happened here? What are you doing? And I explained it to them. And they say, oh, help me out with this. Teach me that. They were interested. In other words, kids my age were interested in how to remember easier and in a fun way and et cetera, et cetera. So I started to teach it to personal people that way. So as I say, that's what changed my life. Obviously, I kept using it because, see, I started to realize, and I've written this so many times in all my books, the first thing that I started to realize and that everybody must realize is that the word remember, the word know, K-N-O-W, and the word learn are all synonyms. They all mean the same thing. If you remember something, you know it, and you've learned it. If you learn something, you've remembered it, and you know it. Do you see what I mean? In other words, they're synonyms. Listen, in one of my books, one of my early books, I'm going back 30 years, I wrote in the front of the book, there is no learning without memory. That's my quote, okay? And I said it very strongly. There is no learning without memory. Now, why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this, Michael, because that started a whole thing in my local education department, because all the teachers got up in arms and said, how can you say that? Well, I got to tell you something. In those years, we would debate it, and I never lost that debate, never, because without memory, there is no learning. To me, that's so obvious. How can you say you learned something if you haven't remembered it?
So you were consulting or helping your schoolmates. When was the very first, like, part of your information product done? Like, you know, when did you first put some of what you were learning down pen and paper where you had something that you could sell as an information product?
Okay, I'm going to answer that question. That's a whole other area. You mentioned David Roth before, so my assumption is, you know, a little bit about magic.
I watched some of his videos, and it's interesting, the coin manipulation.
Okay, I don't know if you know that I've written about 30 books on the subject.
I didn't know you had that many books on magic.
Yeah, that's sort of an advocation. I just finished one that's out on the market right now, but that's a cliche kind of thing. You know, it's just certain people that are interested in the subject. But my magic books are bestsellers. Comparing your bestseller in magic to a bestseller of my memory books is like a joke. You know, it's like you're comparing 2,000 copies, which is considered a great bestseller in magic, to a 3,000, which my books do, or a little more, to hundreds of thousands for my books on memory. So it's a labor of love, but it's the kind of labor that I do love. You know, I like to do it. I don't lose any money on it.
Yeah, you enjoy it. It's a passion.
Yeah, and mostly my stuff is card work. David Roth is a coin man. I'm a card man.
I watched some of your magic tricks on your website, which were excellent.
There you go. Okay, so now let me ask you a question. Going back, I must have been 20 years old or 19 years old. I had a magic place in the back of somebody's store. There was a store on 52nd Street. It's now a big record store, but he had dishes and cups and things like that. It was a big store, and I rented the back of his store for a magic counter, which is what I had for a while. People like Dunninger used to come, and he became a friend because he was going to do a show doing magic. His area was mind reading, but he had to do a show, and he'd come and he'd ask me. I was a kid. I was 18, 19 years old. Anyway, people started to know me there and etc. Anyway, long story short, a friend of mine by the name of Leslie Spiewak, unfortunately he's gone now, but he walks into the store, and he knew I was interested in memory because I was doing magic for people using memory with a deck of cards, things like that. And he said, Harry, I just took a memory course. He said, I could sell that man across the street. He pointed to a cigar store, and I can still visualize this so clearly. You know, one man sitting there rolling cigars, you know. And he said, I can sell that guy a memory course right now. And I said, yeah, of course you could. What are you talking about, Leslie? He explained it to me. He said, you and I, we should get into this business. He said, you know, my father is like the president of a B'nai B'rith or whatever club he belonged to, or a Masons. He said, we can go there and demonstrate, etc. I said, Leslie, demonstrate what? We went up to my apartment, and in 5 minutes, I wrote an act, something to demonstrate in front of an audience.
Memory.
Yeah, well, because I sat down, and I said, look, what's the main thing people have trouble remembering? I said, names. So let's demonstrate how to remember names. What's the next thing? Oh, they hide things, and then they forget where to hide them. I invented a routine called objects in hiding places. I said, what else? Well, Americans are card players. Let's teach them how to remember cards. And everybody wants to remember what they read. Let's do a demonstration. We'll memorize the pages of the magazine. Those are the things I came up with in about 5 minutes. Now, Leslie said, yeah, but how are we going to do it? How are we going to demonstrate these things? Well, now I had to come up with the methods, which is what I did. And I'm getting to the point to answer your question when you said, when did you first put things in writing? We started to demonstrate this. I put the act together, Leslie and I, each of us doing half the memory.
Tell me about your first act. You've got to be able to remember the first act, the first time you did it in front of people.
It was not very good. First of all, Leslie was the kind of guy, if he couldn't think of something, he'd put his fingers up on his forehead, and he would think quietly, you know. And I'm the kind of person, I don't know if you noticed, I'm a talker. There's no silence when I'm on stage, and I've been on stage most of my life. And I don't like silence unless it's done for a reason. But that silence that I couldn't stand. The point there is that I memorized everything. All the half of the memory work we did that he was supposed to do, I memorized anyway. So that as time went by and we went to other B'nai B'riths and other Mason lodges, when he put his fingers up on his forehead to think, I said, Leslie, that's so-and-so, and I would tell him. what it is, so that there was no lengths of silence.
Did it become like a straight man, funny man routine?
You know, almost, because you're reminding me of another thing. When Leslie quit, and an agent said to me, Harry, don't you realize you're a young Jan Murray? That was a big comic of the day. Leslie's holding you back, things like that. You know, I could write a book, Michael. But to answer your basic question, what happened is we started to appear at no cost. We didn't charge anything because we thought we'd sign up students. You ready for that? We were going to teach. We never signed up a student. Never.
No one asked to be taught?
No. Never signed up a student, but everyone said, oh, gee, I belong to the Red Men. I belong to this Mason group. Would you appear there? We said, sure. Always thinking that we'd sign up students, but we never did. So finally, I sat down and I wrote a 10-chapter memory course called the Memory Aid Course. And what we started to do is at the end of our demonstration, we would sell these for $10. And that started to bring in a couple of dollars anyway. And then what happened is an agent saw us one day and said, how much are you guys getting for these? I was carrying heavy blackboards in those days, and et cetera. Became death of a salesman, for God's sakes. Anyway, he said, what are you guys getting? I don't know. He said, well, we're just getting expenses, $10, $20. He said, I'll get you $85 a show. And he became our manager. His name was Harry Lee. And he started to book us for getting $85 a show.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. All right, I want to ask you, so he was your manager, and I'm curious about this. When a manager comes on, like, what was your deal? How did you negotiate? What did he make? What was his job?
Sure I do. I made a big mistake, and I've written this. I'm doing a memoir. Mel Brooks told me to call it a re-memoir. He was getting 25% of whatever we earned, and it got to a point after Leslie disappeared, which is another part of the story, which I'll tell you if you want to hear it.
Sure.
When I was working by myself with my wife, and we started to really make money, he got ill. He never even answered the phone. He became a telephone answering service. But then he wanted 25% of everything I did, like writing books and stuff. And I said, no.
Leslie did.
Yeah, that's it.
So when the manager signed you, he got 25%.
25%.
And was it a fixed-term contract?
Like I say, I was very nice. You know, you have to understand, I have 1 year of high school, Michael. I wasn't too smart in those days. I signed a contract in perpetuity. I did that with my first book also. That book is still being published by somebody that I don't want to publish it, but there's nothing I could do about it because, as they say, I signed contracts in perpetuity. Probably a lawyer could get me out of it, but it ain't worth it.
How old were you when you had printed that first 10-chapter report?
Oh, God, I must have been 23, 24 years old.
Okay, so you started selling them. This manager saw what you were doing. He said, I can get you more for the shows.
Yes, and he did start to get his point, but we had to give him 25%. But what happened after a while, we weren't making that much money, and Leslie one day said to me, Harry, I got to go out of town for 3 months. I got to make some money. He said, I have 2 kids. I need to make some more money. And his father was a manufacturer of men's clothing, so he was going to go out and sell, you know, his father's clothing. He said, I got to do it. So I said, fine. I called the agent that we were booked for one show that we had to do after Leslie left, and I called this agent. His name was Lou Price. We used to call him Low Price, Lou Price. I still remember these things. Like I say, Michael, I can write a book. So anyway, I called him. I'll give you another plot point now. And I said, Lou, you have to cancel that show. He said, what? What are you talking about? There's paper all over the place. And I don't know what it was, an imprint or something like that. He said, you got to do it. I said, I can't. He said, why? I said, because, you know, a lot of things I do, I need 30 seconds, like when I memorize a deck of cards. Leslie would talk for 30 seconds, and that's when it settled him. He said, Harry, that's what I told you before. Don't you know Leslie's been holding you back, blah, blah, blah. He said, you have a gorgeous wife. Why don't you have her do it? I said, well, my wife was a model, so she appeared in front of large groups, but not with talking, you know what I mean? She just was modeling clothes. He said, have her talk for you, because I needed that 30 seconds in certain areas. So I said, let me check with my wife. I did. I said, we got to do this, blah, blah, blah. Okay, long story short, we end up doing the show. My wife got up to introduce me, you know, breathing heavy, nervous. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, we were both so nervous, Michael. And anyway, talk about a plot point. What happened was the fact that there was no silence when I was working, and more important, I was remembering all these things things, not half of these things, but all of them. What happened is we ended up getting a 10-minute standing ovation. We were drenched in sweat, but we got a 10-minute standing ovation. We went into the dressing room, both of us breathing sighs of relief. And, oh, boy, we're glad that it's over. And in comes Lou Price, and he says, "Hey, Harry, you did great." I said, "I'm glad I did it for you, Lou. That's it. I got to find another way to make a living." He said, "What are you talking about? I just booked 12 more shows for you."
Were you surprised that you were able to remember everything?
Not really. I was doing it while Leslie was around anyway, but kind of keeping it in the background only for the times that he put his fingers on his forehead and thought silently.
What were a couple of the things in the show that you did, you know, some of the amazing feats of memory you did in those shows back then?
Well, first of all, we started off with the Objects in Hiding Place. Objects in Hiding Places was a big blackboard with 16 squares on it. See, most of the things I did, a lot of them anyway, I looked for laughs. See, I'm basically an entertainer, and memory and magic is my media, really.
Yes.
Anyway, what happened with Objects in Hiding Places, they were numbered from 1 to 16, and I would tell the people in the audience, "Look, I want you to call any number, any order, and call out an object at any ridiculous hiding place." Like they might say, the lamp hidden in the television set. And I would get, like, somebody would call Elizabeth Taylor hidden in my bed, and I'd say, "That's not ridiculous, that's wishful thinking." You know? In other words, I worked for laughs. So what happened, as these things were called, Renee, that was part of her job, my wife, would write them in the square that was called until all the squares were full, and then I would call them off in order. Number one is so-and-so, number two is Elizabeth Taylor hidden in your bed, Mr. Jones, you know, blah, blah, blah. Incidentally, that was the second thing I did. The first thing I did was to remember the names of everybody in the audience. I would say with the few people I met, please stand up. When I said few, which I said a few times, the whole audience would stand up, which would get gasped right away even before I did it. And then I called everybody's name, seating him as I called him. Then I went into the Objects in Hiding Place. The next thing was a playing card demonstration done with giant cards. Very quickly, where four people came up behind me, they had half the deck, which they separated into clubs, hearts, spades, and diamonds. The fifth guy was shuffling the other half deck as much as he wanted. Then he would call them off. I had a snapper, and I would snap. So he did it quickly. He would hand the card to Renee, who put it on a special blackboard I had numbered from 1 to 28, although there were usually only 26 cards, because I was pretty good at cutting the giant deck exactly in half. And then the whole concept was that I would tell the four people behind me not only which cards they were holding, but where the cards they weren't holding in their suit on the blackboard. In other words, when the man with the clubs came to me, I'd say, "Give me the cards that you have," as I call them. "You've got the ace of clubs, the two of clubs. You don't have the three of clubs because that's the 14th card on the blackboard." That was the point that I did with all four.
As you did these shows and as you practiced these memory feats, did you see your memory improving over time?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'll tell you what, it became an effort. When I became known and popular, Michael, sometimes I was doing three shows a day. You know, my wife and I did the act for 20 years after that, first thing I told you about. We did it for 20 years because she once said to me, "Harry, I don't want to ever say ladies and gentlemen again," because she used to open the show that way. "Ladies and gentlemen, I want to talk to you about Harry Lorraine." So because we wanted a child at that time, we had just turned 40, et cetera, et cetera. So as we were doing it, the hard part that I started to tell you is we got so well known, I was doing breakfast shows, luncheon shows, and evening shows. The hard part was when I got to the second show, and for example, somebody would call off what card is number 23. The card that was in number 23 came to me was for the first show, but I knew that, so I had to do that extra mental calisthenic of eliminating the first one and go to the present one.
I see. Did you do any kind of exercise?
No, no. My work was my exercise.
Your work was your exercise?
Oh, sure.
Did you ever learn to juggle?
No.
What's your dominant hand?
Dominant is right hand. But a lot of card work I do, I do with my left hand. For example, most people spread from left to right. I spread from right to left with the deck of cards. Don't ask me why. It's just what came naturally.
Anything else left hand other than that?
Yeah, mostly with the card work. Other than that, no. Now I'm going to tell you how the first book came to be.
Did you still have the same agent that you signed up with, your same manager?
No. There were a couple of things happened that made me want to get rid of them, and it cost me some money to get rid of them, which was unnecessary, I learned afterwards. But
our listeners are entrepreneurs, and you've learned life lessons about making deals and signing contracts. So put a little lesson in there for the students, maybe a mistake that you made.
Well, the obvious mistake is when you sign a contract, get a lawyer. You know, I mean, I just signed what was important to me, like my first book contract. which was a big mistake. But I learned as I went on. Now I don't have a manager. I'm my own manager. But I found out, don't you see, that the contract I signed with my original manager would never have held up in a court because it was in perpetuity, and those contracts are not allowed, I found out. But I didn't know it when I signed it. And then he started to do things. Oh, we did a show, and when we were finished, it was at a church, and the priest of the church came, and he gave me two envelopes. One was marked Mr. Memory Marvel. The other one was marked Mrs. Memory Marvel. There was a $20 bill in each one. He had tipped us. So I stopped the telephone. I called him. I said, sir, you know, we get paid for this. But he said, I know, but I felt like doing it. Why am I telling you this? I told it to my agent, Harry Lee. Well, we settled up at the end of the month. He took 25% of the $40. Those are the kind of things that started to bother me. We were called Harry and Renee Lorraine, the Memory Marvels. We were getting so busy that he didn't want to sign it by hand on every contract. So he got a rubber stamp, which cost $6.50. He took 25% of that off my money to pay for the rubber stamp. Then my first book came about, and I told him about it, and he said, of course, I get 25% of that, and that was the end of it.
Let me interrupt you. Was the first book the 10-chapter book that you put together?
No. What happened was, we started to work in the Catskill Mountains, what's called the Borscht Belt, and one day I finished my performance, and a man came over to me, and he said, Harry, can you teach this stuff? And in those young years, I was the kind of guy, I said yes to anything. If somebody said to me, can you play piano, I would say, I don't know, I never tried. I was that kind of person. And he said to me, can you teach this? I said, yeah. He said, would you send me a couple of chapters? And he gives me his card. And he's a literary agent. Scott Meredith was his name. The agency still exists, I think. Anyway, I took this memory aid course that I had written. I took the first couple of sections and I rewrote them. And I sent it to him. He sent it to a publisher. And that was my first book, How to Develop a Superpower Memory. I got a $500 advance, Michael. And I was frightened because I thought if the book didn't make it, I would have to give back the $500.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Okay, so tell me, from all our students who are self-publishers, you had a literary agent, and he sent it to a publisher. The publisher gave you an advance on the book. How was that structured? What was your deal on that?
Like I say, I still have the contract. It's a contract in perpetuity. In other words, the way it was written, I would owe allegiance to this company for the rest of my life.
Just for this literary work, this book.
Yes, and the agent allowed it. He allowed a lot of things. We get back to Gene Schwartz. My first connection with Gene Schwartz is when he wrote a 3,000-word ad for How to Develop a Superpower Memory. I wrote the headline. It said, give me one evening and I'll give you a push-button memory.
I want to get to the Gene Schwartz stuff, but I want to separate that. Go back to this publishing deal for your first book. What did the deal look like? You got a $500 advance, and what kind of percentage would you make on book sales?
Gee, I guess it was 10% in those days. I don't have it in front of me.
Did they perform? I mean, did it do well?
What do you mean, the book?
Yeah, the book, the first book.
It sold 8 million copies. You know why it sold 8 million copies? Because of Gene Schwartz.
Okay, so you have this first book. So how did the connection from the first book to Gene Schwartz to you happen?
Frederick Fell contacted Gene Schwartz, who contacted me and said, I wanted to do an ad for your book, which incidentally he did, and it ran in many languages all over the world.
Oh, so Gene Schwartz was hooked up with the publisher.
Yes.
What was the publisher called then?
It was Frederick Fell Incorporated.
So it was his own publishing company?
Yes, it still exists, but taken over by a different man. It's called Lifetime Books or Frederick Fell Incorporated.
Now, back then, what kind of books was he publishing? Was it a certain genre of type of book?
Not really. He published whatever he could get his hands on.
Was he big time back then or kind of small?
No, not at all.
Okay, so he had the contact with Gene Schwartz. He knew Gene Schwartz was the copywriter.
Exactly.
And he hooked you guys up.
Right. Incidentally, Gene Schwartz ended up publishing a few of my books. He published them. He had a different company called Information Incorporated.
Yes. Okay, well, let's go from the beginning. Your very first contact with Gene Schwartz, because this is fascinating. Talk about that.
You know, we got together, and he started to ask me questions, you know, about the memory thing.
Where did you meet?
I think in my apartment in those days. I was living in Whitestone, Queens in those days, I remember, and he came there.
And he came there to talk to you with the intention of creating an ad for your book.
Oh, yes.
He had already studied your book, probably.
He had, and, you know, there are certain memories that are very good with Gene Schwartz, but the first memory isn't, because, you know, I told you it sold 8 million copies, you know, what I was getting per book? I was getting 2 cents a book that sold, so that was another thing that my agent, Scott Meredith, in those years allowed. It never should have been allowed. But then Frederick Fell said to me, Harry, you got to do another book, obviously, because this, they were selling like crazy, but you got to understand, in those days, you know what the book was selling for? $2.95 or something like that. You know, it's a different world. You know, I had a little problem there, which is kind of interesting. I don't know if you'll find it interesting. Don't forget that my whole thing was making it look like I was a genius. You know, I get up and do all these things. And incidentally, to end, when you ask me, what did I do on stage? After I did the objects in the hiding places and the names of everybody in the audience and then the car thing, and I left out, I had a copy of Time magazine, which Renee would hand out. Before we even went on, we would tear it down the binding, take out the staples, and hand out the loose pages so people would call any page number, and I would tell them what was on that page, or vice versa. They'd say there's a picture of President Nixon on the upper left. They'd say that's page 76, and on the lower right, there's so-and-so. You know what I mean? And then the strong part was I would say, you can test me on anything you want as quickly as you want, and people would call out anything. What's number 14 on the blackboard? That's the Ace of Clubs. Number 14 on the objects hiding places is Elizabeth Taylor under the bed. Number 14 in the magazine, etc. As you can tell, I'm a fast talker. That was my thing, the machine gun delivery there on anything they called.
You said you had a little problem. What are we referring to?
What I'm talking about, it's not really a problem. In other words, when I finished working, the assumption was that here's this genius that could do this and nobody else can, and here I just wrote a book saying that anybody could do it. So that was the obstacle we had to get over to prove that, no, I'm not a genius and anybody can do it.
Well, that's, you were just demonstrating that it could be done.
But we didn't actually do it that way. We made it look like I was this great genius.
Was this a contradiction that Gene Schwartz understood when he was trying? Okay, so you guys talked about this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And he said, no, we're going to explain. Look, it was a 3,000-word ad that he wrote with, incidentally, a very mysterious-looking picture of me in the middle.
It's very interesting. So he came to your apartment, and you guys are talking. Can you remember anything about that day? Because I'm trying to bring the listeners back to Gene Schwartz's methods for creating wonderful, powerful ad copy.
Well, you know, I didn't sit with him when he worked. He would show me his copy after he wrote it, and I very rarely had to change much. I would change some things that I thought were important, but basically he would write the ad, I would okay it, and it would go.
But do you think when you met, did he record the call by any chance?
No.
He just took notes?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you were an enthusiastic talker, and you probably talked a lot when you met with him, right?
Oh, sure.
And he was an incredible listener, and he was just listening for your words.
Oh, absolutely. And he used mostly my words when he wrote it, and that's okay. I mean, I knew more about the subject, obviously, than he did. But like I say, afterwards, he published a couple of books for mine. One was called The Memory Isometrics Course, and another one was called The Mental Magnetism Course, which he published under the name Information Incorporated.
All right, I want to get to that. I want to just do a little chronological. Your first book that went on to sell 8 million copies,
yeah.
Did you ever do a second book with that publisher?
Yes, I did 2 books with them.
Were you locked in? Like, when you do a contract, do you sign like a 2 or 3 or 4 book contract, or did
no.
you just agree for one?
Oh, that's another old story. The way it is, if you were to sign a contract now, boilerplate publisher's contract, the publisher always has the option for the next book. My book, The Memory Book, which probably most people would know, is the one that, you know, was on the New York Times bestseller list for over a year. It's the only book on memory trading that was ever on the bestseller list. That was published by Stein and Day. Then he published another book for me called Remembering People. And then he was a bit of a crook, and I didn't want to do any more books for him. But the boilerplate on those 2 contracts was that he had the option. The name of his company was Stein and Day. His name was Saul Stein. And he had the option for the next book. At that time, fortunately, I was with a very good literary agent by the name of Owen Lasner, who was the head of the literary department of William Morris. They're very important. So I told him I didn't want to do another book for Stein and Day. He said, well, Harry, the only way to get out of this contract is to have him turn down a book or have somebody bid higher than him for one of your books. So I said, what, for example? You know what I did? One of my books, the only book I ever wrote on magic for the public, is a book called The Magic Book, which Putnam published. But I wrote it for one reason. I knew that Saul Stein was not happy with The Magic Book. He had just published a couple of books on magic by somebody else that were not very good. But Owen Lasner, the William Morris guy had to give it to him first. And Sahlstein did bid. But then what Poland Lassner did was he made it an auction. He sent it to other publishers because you're allowed to do that. And we would get a higher bid and he'd have to go back to Sahlstein and say, well, we just got $3,000 more or $10,000 more, whatever. And it kept going that way until Sahlstein backed out. And that's when Putnam had overbid him. Now, the next problem, which I remember Owen Lassner saying to me, he said, all right, Harry, first problem solved. We just got rid of Sahlstein, and Putnam wants to publish the book. Now, you got to write the bloody book.
Did you have to write it for Putnam?
I wrote it for Putnam. They put it out. They sold 125,000 copies of that book called The Magic Book.
So back then, you didn't even have the book written, but you could submit it.
I submitted a little outline, which Owen Lassner helped me do. But then I had to write the book. It sold to the public. I told you, 125,000 copies. Then Putnam, a big institution, took them over. And they said, no, we don't want to publish it anymore. They gave me back the rights, and that's it. Now I republished it for the Magic Fraternity.
So Schwartz did the ad for, what was the title of that book?
The first one was How to Develop a Superpower Memory.
All right, so after he came out with the ad and he showed it, you said, this looks great. Did you think it looked fantastic?
Oh, sure. It built up my ego, my God, yeah.
Okay, so then after you approved it and the ad started running, did you see the ad all over the place?
All over the place in every magazine with over 5,000 circulation and every newspaper with over 5,000 circulation.
At that time, did you understand the power of full-page ads written by this man at that time?
Not really.
When the ads were all over the place, what did you see happen? Take me through the progress.
What I saw happen was books being sold and some money coming in, but also recognizability. I started to be recognized, which was nice. I have a big ego. And being recognized, saying, aren't you the guy, etc.? Yeah, that was very nice. But that was basically it. I'll tell you another story. I told you there was a picture in the middle that they used of me when I was much younger, of course. I don't know if you ever saw that. Well, the Wall Street Journal called one day because the Wall Street Journal was running it once a week, every week or maybe more, and doing a lot of business, selling a lot of books. And once Gene Schwartz or Fred Fell got the call, now I don't know who got the call originally, where the Wall Street Journal said, listen to this, they said, we're getting a few letters from people saying, what are you trying to do with that ad for Harry Lorraine? You're trying to get him to hypnotize us into buying the book? Because it was that mysterious looking picture. They said, no, we're sorry, we're getting complaints, we can't run the ad with that picture anymore. So what we did, and I have the original painting here, they did a caricature of that picture. In other words, it was no longer that mystery-looking kind of picture. You know what happened? The sales went way down. I guess I was hypnotizing people. Unless it was coincidental, because they had been running the ad for years. That ad ran from 1956 to about 1960.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. How many books do you think that one ad was responsible for selling?
Oh, it had to sell a couple of million, and it's been over the years it's kept selling. But, I mean, it was a vast number, but like I told you, in those days, now you buy a book, what is it, $24.95, $29.95? They were $2.95 or $3.95 in those days.
Would you get letters from your students all the time?
Oh, yeah. I have letters you can't believe. I have testimonials. Oh, God.
Has it changed people's lives?
Oh, my God, did I ever. I have people who had brain tumors that told me I saved their lives. For my television infomercial, one of the important testimonials, people can go to that. I don't know if you'll let me say my websites.
Absolutely, yeah, give your websites.
Well, if people go to HarryLorraine.com, that's where I sell the memory power course. It's HarryLorraine.com. Obviously, you got to spell it right, you know, L-O-R-A-Y-N-E, etc. HarryLorraine.com, and there's a section there for testimonials that you click on. One of them is from a guy by the name of Bob Norland, who had a stroke when he was 75, and he wrote me this letter. He lived in California. And he said that he had the stroke, and the doctor told him that he would never be able to remember anything again. And he said, somebody brought him one of my books, and he said, Mr. Lorraine, I got to tell you that I remember better now than I did before the stroke. He's in a wheelchair. And he said, I can't write, and I'm still in business. I take telephone orders, so I have to remember the names, addresses, the orders, because I can't write because of the stroke, and you just saved my life. He said, I give demonstrations at my Toastmasters Club using your systems. He said, and God bless you, Harry. So, I mean, testimonials like that.
How is your penmanship, personally, your writing?
I write pretty clearly because that's communication.
Do you write cursive or print?
No, I write both. But basically, when I'm writing a book, it's cursive.
So when you write your book, do you write it out freehand?
Always. I write everything first, and then I edit as I type.
Okay, wait. You write it first, and then you'll retype it into a computer.
Right, right. The computer just with my last few books, because for years I worked first with the standard typewriter, and then I went into the electronic typewriter. I was a typewriter guy.
So when you wrote your books, you wrote them out in cursive?
Always, in longhand. That's the way I write. I write on a legal pad.
And you write with your right hand?
Yes.
Are you a musician at all?
No, not at all. I can't carry a tune in a basket. But what's interesting is my son is in the music business. But no, I have no talent in that area. But a lot of people tell me they use my systems to remember music, which is interesting. But, you know, I mention a thing like that, and they say, you know, that's okay. And I guess it's important to the people who use it for that. But you know what's very important to me? I'm going to read you a quote from the back of one of my books, okay? Listen to this. I have been using Harry Lorraine's memory training techniques for years for myself and for Alzheimer patients. I have had very gratifying results with my patients. Mr. Lorraine's systems probably have better clinical results than the currently available medicines. End quotes. This is from a Dr. Steven Zuckerman, a neurologist. Those are the things that end up making it worthwhile for me.
Have you ever gone into the study of how memory affects the brain? Is that something that's fascinated you, that you've dived into the research on that?
No, I'm very careful about that, Michael. You know, I know about eidetic imagery and sine waves in the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, but I've never even used the word mnemonics in my books. I'll tell you why. I am very result-oriented. People who go to these things and they hear all these fancy words and all, they nod. Doesn't help them any. It's like I said on that ad we talked about, Gene Schwartz. Give me one evening and I'll give you a push-button memory. Because if you get my course, the memory power course, the first evening you will do things with your memory that you never could do before. But you wouldn't be able to do that if I talked about the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere and sine waves and eidetic imagery. That's fine for professors and people that are interested in that.
The average person, it's not going to interest them.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. People that come to me, and when I say come to me, I mean buy my books or my courses, they want to learn how to remember. When I was very young, one of the things I did when I started to write was to go to classes where they said they will teach you how to pay attention. They didn't say how to memorize, but how to pay attention. And I would go to these classes, but it always ended up after they talked, they used that phrase. They said, all you have to do is pay attention. When I got older, I would shout it out and say, wait a minute, I know that. Tell me how. How do I pay attention? That they never did. That's what I do. I teach people how to pay attention.
You said you had to be careful about mentioning the brain, left hemisphere, right hemisphere.
Yeah.
What did you mean by be careful about that? From a legal standpoint?
No. From a standpoint of not selling books, because that's not what people want. People buy my stuff. They buy my memory power course, which incidentally, I can tell you that story, why I devised the memory power course. But the people who go into that, they want to learn how to remember.
For themselves.
Exactly. And talking about eidetic imagery and sine waves, who cares? It's what I call to those people's pie in the sky.
But let me ask you this. Today, with technology and the advancements in understanding the brain, I mean, do you believe that a memory system can help stem the tide of Alzheimer's and dementia?
Well, I just read you a quote from somebody who said that the Alzheimer patients using my systems, his exact words, he says they have better clinical results than the currently available medicine. Look, you know, when I wrote my first book, let's go back to 1956 again. Don't forget I had jet black hair then, because I was very young. Now I have very little gray hair, all right? With my first book, when I really wasn't very well known, who the hell ever heard of Harry Lorraine in those years, except people that saw me in the Borscht Belt, or as I got to be more important than Masons and, you know, higher class kind of groupings. Nobody knew me. But in my first book, I stressed the importance of exercising your mind. And one of the examples I used, which is a childish example, I said if you kept your right arm hanging down and didn't use it for 6 months, you would never be able to use it again. And the same with your brain. You know, it's the cliche, use it or lose it. But nobody paid attention, Michael. Nobody paid attention in 1956 when I screamed and yelled, you have to exercise your mind. Now, all of a sudden, that's very important. Everybody's yelling about exercising your mind and do crossword puzzles and all that silliness. I can do the Times crossword puzzle in an hour, I'm finished, but after a while, it gets to be a bore. It's no longer exercise. The best mental exercise there is are applying my systems, whether you think they're going to work or not.
Okay. You've got Schwartz, who's launched that book, and you did two additional books with that. What was the publisher called?
Frederick Fell Incorporated. We're sitting having lunch, and he said, Harry, you got to do another book. I said, Fred, I've said it all. I really thought I did at that time. Who dreamed that I would write 30 more books or whatever? I said, no, I've said it all. He took a paper napkin. He wrote down how to utilize your time, how to get rid of bad habits, how to establish good habits, and he wrote down about 13 sentences like that. He said, give me a book on this. I didn't know anything about that. So I did a little research on how to utilize your time, how to get rid of bad habits, and things like that. Then I made up my own things about it, and then ended up, I have letters on my wall from people saying they were ready to commit suicide and that this book saved their lives. It was called Secrets of Mind Power. And I have a plaque on my wall from him and Gene Schwartz when it hit 250,000 copies. They sent me a plaque. Secrets of Mind Power, it was called. Actually, it was just basic self-help. There was only one chapter in there on memory.
How is the deal with your second and third book compared to that first publisher, royalties? Do you get treated better with that?
Yes, the second book was a little better. I mean, I have a current book out right now called Ageless Memory, which is interesting. You know why? It's geared toward people with my color hair. Ageless Memory is geared toward older people. You know, did I remember to take my pill kind of thing. The systems are the same, but it's geared more toward older people, which is why it's called Ageless Memory. I wanted to call it the Over 40 Memory Book, but the publisher didn't want to do that.
How is it going?
Very well. It's been out there for a while. And, you know, it goes from one end of the scale to the other. I read you the first quote on the back, on the hardback. The paperback doesn't have these quotes, but on the hardback, I just read you Dr. Steven Zuckerman's about Alzheimer's. But the one on the bottom is from Alan Alda, you know, the actor. He says, Harry Lorraine can make you remember an address book full of phone numbers as if it were your first kiss. When I go on stage with 100 pages of text in my head, they got their thanks to the method. The Harry Lorraine method. That's Alan Alda. I have a letter on my wall from Annie Bancroft who said, thank you so much for making the drudgery part of my creative art. And she goes on to explain what the drudgery is. The drudgery is memorizing a script, because how can you get up and act if you haven't memorized the script, if you have to think what the heck is the next word? And she ends up by saying, you are a miracle worker. Listen, if I'm going to drop names, I was introduced back in August of 2001, I was introduced to Colin Powell when they said, Mr. Secretary of State, meet Harry Lorraine. Colin Powell said, and I'm quoting now, and I use this in Ageless Memory, I write about it. He said, Harry Lorraine, and he threw his arms around me and he said, you helped make me a general.
Did he explain how?
No, and I was too awestricken to say, would you put that in writing? I would like to use that quote. I have pictures of me and him with our arms around each other. I'm looking at them right now. They're on my desk with my other awards.
Tell me some others.
Well, Sir Anthony Hopkins, the actor, uses my systems. Mel Brooks does. I told you about Addie Bancroft. The mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, has become a friend. We go to dinner together. Of course, he uses my systems. He wants to learn to speak Spanish, which he does very well. But he'll call me once a month and say, Harry, how the heck? Do I remember this? You know, and he'll give me an example and I help him. And Commissioner Ray Kelly uses my system. So there are very important people all over the world who use my systems.
How is it the brain, by using the mnemonic devices,
yes,
in creating images in the mind and the stories, why is it the brain can remember that and have such a hard time the other way?
Well, I'll break down the basics of my systems for you, okay? All my work and all memory is based on the reminder principle. This is the title I've given it. We all go through life snapping our fingers either physically or mentally and saying, oops, that reminds me. And usually the thing that you were reminded of had nothing to do with the thing that did the reminding. It's if you made a subconscious connection between the two things, then you remembered it. If you didn't make that connection, then you forgot it. Forgot in quotes. You never really remembered it in the first place. So all memory is based on reminders. In other words, a name to a face, a foreign language word to its English meaning. All memory problems boil down to entities of two, okay? Like the examples I just gave you. And that's what I teach, how to make one thing remind you of another. That's the basic concept of all my systems. But how do you do that with numbers, for example? How in the world do you visualize a number? Numbers are just concepts. What does 5 mean to you, except it's one lower than 6 and one higher than 4? It's very difficult to visualize, except for me and my students. So my students can visualize numbers physically, definitely, then you can remember them. So that's what it boils down to, the reminder principle.
You said you were dyslexic. Did you ever do any research on dyslexia? Please continue to part 2.